on the Mark Steiner Show. Before we jump into our conversation with two of the Green candidates here in the state of Maryland, we were going to have three, but unfortunately one person couldn't make it because we had to shift times because Marilyn Mosby is joining us at 11, and with just the nature of live radio. But we do have folks in the studio about to take that conversation on. But before we get there, I want two things I want to say. One is that I want to thank everybody who had contributed during WEA's membership drive and making it a success and contributing during our program. It meant a great deal. And I want to thank you all for that. And you can still contribute. Don't stop at WEA.org anytime you'd like. Designate our show, of course, but if you'd like. But go in there and you can make that pledge. And I want to thank everybody. And one of the fellow men who called in, Tom, whose last name I don't have in front of me, as soon as I get it, I will give you his last name, is U.S. Army veteran. It's the first time he's ever given to any station ever. And we want to thank him and all the others who are first-time members of joining WEA during our membership drive. I want to thank you all for that. And also, I want to remind you as we jump off into this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn more about the issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org is Maryland State Education Association's banner with information there. We're joined here in studio, once again, by Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is a Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate, organizer with Popular Resistance, co-director of its OurEconomy.us, co-host of Clearing the Fog Radio, and Miles Honig, Green Party candidate for Congress in Maryland's 7th District, Congressional District, high school teacher, lifelong advocate for social justice, and board member of Marin Tessel. Tessel.
Past member.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888. You can write to us here, talk at steinershow.org. You can email us, as I said, or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So, Margaret, let me just begin. It was something we were talking about before we went on the air, and we didn't have a chance to hear all of it. But
sure.
There is a debate taking place this Wednesday evening coming
right.
between senatorial candidates right. and sponsored by League of Women Voters on television. Right?
That's right.
And you're not invited.
Right. So there, Chris Van Hollen has only agreed to two kind of live on-air debates. One was on the Kojo Namdi show a couple weeks ago.
Oh, I remember that, right.
And then one televised debate in Baltimore, even though Kathy Schlegel wanted more than that, and I've been calling for more than that. Chris Van Hollen has said publicly now a couple of times that he's willing to debate me on televised debate. Kathy Schlegel, the Republican Senate candidate, has said that she's willing to debate me. This particular debate is being sponsored by the University of Baltimore Center for Public Policy with the League of Women Voters, the Baltimore Sun, and WJZ. And they initially set out four criteria. You know, you have to be on the ballot, you have to have a campaign office and staff, show evidence of a statewide campaign, and if there's a poll available, you need to be polling more than 15%.
And there's the rub.
Well, so they initially told me that they were going to decide by September 16th. And as of that date, I met all of those criteria. There was no poll. But then when they found out that there was going to be a poll conducted, they postponed their decision until later to wait for those polling results. And so I can only construe that they were doing that because they wanted to find a way to exclude me from the debate. And so... But then, you know, when I reached out to them and they made their decision not to include me, the University of Baltimore is saying, we're not taking a position. This is the sponsor's decision. The WJZ and Baltimore Sun say, we're using League of Women Voters criterion. League of Women Voters are imposing a 15% criterion and they won't change that. But so it's really up to the League of Women Voters to decide whether they're going to impose a criterion that makes it so that only people who have millions of dollars, who can buy the media, get the exposure so they can get their name out there, can be in the debate, where the United States' own criteria that they use internationally say that candidates should debate first, and then when people hear their positions, then there should be polling done.
So just you can both comment on this, but where in the United States is there any place in the United States right now where there are major races taking place and public debates, televised or not, where there is not like a 15% threshold? I mean, in almost every discussion I've had with people as we plan debates here or other places over the last 20-some years, people always look for some kind of threshold. Can all seven people come in, for argument's sake, let's say there's seven.
Mm-hmm.
How do you whittle that down? Who are the serious candidates? How do you make that choice? How do you make that decision for the public?
There are a lot of ways to make that choice. And Kojo Namda used a 10% polling criterion. Again, these are very arbitrary. They're just, there's
no,
you know.
No, they're very arbitrary.
And they go against what, you know, the United States recommends internationally. The U.S. international recommendations say you can have up to 8 candidates in a debate. If there's more than 8 candidates, you should have multiple tiers. And then after that, you decide based on the audience, you know, polling who makes it to the next top tiers. The League of Women Voters invited me to participate in a debate on the Eastern Shore. Kathy Schlage and I debated in Y Mills this week. Chris Van Hollen chose not to attend that. So they are using the criteria in one place, but not in another place. And so I really pin this on the League of Women Voters. WJZ has said they're not trying to keep me out. They're just using the league's criterion.
So what do you do about that?
Well,
besides showing up, which I know you probably will.
Who, me? Well, we're asking people to put pressure on the league. I've, you know, reached out to the president of the league, and she's away right now. But and I'm asking people to contact Ralph Watkins. He's the vice president of the league, and he will not. I spoke to him in person 2 days ago, and he will not discuss it. He just says that's what we're doing, and he won't discuss it any further than that. When I said the league has a reputation, has a mission of protecting democracy, informing voters about their choices, you are the sole person enforcing a 15% criterion. You know that that continues the pay-to-play scheme that we're in. How do you defend that when your mission is to inform voters? And he would not discuss it.
Have there been debates in your congressional race?
I was invited to a League of Women Voters debate in Howard County. However, it was canceled twice. One first time, I wasn't informed about it, and then when I called and made some noise, they said, "Well, they rescheduled it for this for last night, 2 nights ago." That was then canceled as well. So I've had other events with African Americans in Howard County and other programs, but no, the league has not been all that supportive. Baltimore City, Baltimore County said that they were not doing it, so they seem to be vacant when it comes to supporting third parties.
So I'm curious, what's the strategy to deal with that before we get into some really serious political questions here, policy questions, I should say. Wayne, what is the strategy to address that?
It's got to be public pressure. You know, 76% of people nationwide want open debates. People are leaving the two major parties. They want to hear more ideas. They recognize that when you have only a Democrat and Republican debating, there's a very restricted dialogue. So it's really up to people to say, you know, we live in a time where we're facing serious crises and we need a broader public discussion of what the solutions are. And third party candidates should be able to debate. Now, in answer to your question, how do you decide who should participate?
Right.
I mean, if you look at the Senate candidates, there are only three of us that have offices, that have staff, that are actively campaigning and, you know, getting out there and showing evidence, raising money, showing evidence of a strong, active campaign. But, you know, I'd be open to having more voices. Like I said, you know, the U.S. international criteria say up to 8 people should be included in a debate. And we did that during the mayoral primary.
So you said that, before we move on, when you said U.S. criteria, where does that come from?
And we don't follow them here in the United States.
But if you look at the
National Democratic Institute put out a report in 2014. It was funded by USAID, and it's called A Guide to Organizing and Producing Debates. And it lays out what they think would be a democratic approach to having candidates' voices heard. And they believe that all candidates' voices need to be heard. And then you poll people based on that to decide who rises to the top and continues, you know, in the process.
Gotcha. So everybody else should do it but us.
Exactly. That's the American exceptionalism.
It's the American way.
Folks, do join us at 410-319-8888. You can also email us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner as we talk with two of the Green Party state candidates, one for Congress, one for Senate, and you, 410-319-8888 is the number to call to join in on that conversation. So this is a very strange election year,
mm-hmm.
as we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about before when you were on with Jill Stein and and Joshua Harris is running for mayor of Baltimore on the Green Party ticket. And there are, you know, that many people are very nervous about the election of Donald Trump, even though you can make a lot of arguments and we can talk about that a bit. And I think for legitimate reason, for his kind of deeply racist views.
Oh, I'm not a fan of Trump. I just don't think he has a chance.
Most of us hope he doesn't have a chance, but that, and I've never said that in the air ever in my 24-year history of interviewing people for campaigns and following campaigns, I've never said I hope somebody doesn't win.
Mm-hmm.
But
Mark.
So the question is, so a lot of people are really reticent mm-hmm. to think about voting third party in this election more than almost any other I've ever heard because of this the nature of this race. So I mean, how do you all respond to that in terms of your races?
Well, if we respond to about the Stein race as well, because you know, I think it's a I agree with Jill when she says she won't be able to sleep well if Donald Trump wins, the same if Hillary Clinton wins. I think we're in a situation where either the two candidates winning would be horrible for this country. So even though Trump has said so many things that are disgusting, despicable, we see Hillary Clinton doing a lot of those very same things. You know, he talks, she acts. And we have a long history of
the opposite of what he said, actually, right? I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, we do have a long history of the Clintons involved in everything from overthrowing governments, from waging wars. And who is the one who's really promoting war with Russia right now? It's both President Obama and Hillary Clinton. Who is scarier? He's horrible. He's disgusting in so many ways. She scares me. And if it's a matter of life and death, you have to make those decisions. So, I would say, so the answer, of course, is Jill Stein. Don't vote for either of the two.
So the question I have, two things you just raised, and you can feel free to jump in since you're running for the Senate,
mm-hmm.
Margaret, here. But talk a bit about what you think that President Obama or Hillary Clinton are trying to push war with Russia. I think they, I've been following pretty closely. I mean, I don't know if I would go to that.
They've been
that
pushing
extreme.
It since President Clinton, when he expanded NATO into Poland and other Eastern European countries. It was an agreement between Gorbachev and President Bush, the older. To if he brings down the wall, not the wall that Trump is talking about, but the Berlin Wall,
right.
That the U.S. would not expand NATO. And as soon as Clinton became president, that was one of the first foreign policy acts that he did. And it's been going on ever since. The actions in Ukraine, where the U.S. helped to instigate almost a neo-Nazi coup in Ukraine, and then blaming it on Russia, saying that Russia invaded Ukraine when they were already in there in the Crimea since the time of Catherine the Great. That was not an invasion. Where do so many of the refugees from Ukraine and Crimea have been going? They've been going back to Russia because they see Russia as their motherland. The U.S. has been putting in missiles all on the border of Eastern Europe, around the southern part of the South Asian part of Russia. We have been the aggressor, and we're yet blaming it on Russia. And it's just a hysteria that's been going on since the Russian Revolution in 1917 of putting everything on the Russians.
Yeah.
Do you have the same viewpoint about that, Margaret?
I do. And actually, Kevin Zeese and I had Ray McGovern on our radio show this week to talk about that. He was the presidential intelligence advisor for 16 years and runs the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And basically, he reminded us that it was in 2013, I think, that Vladimir Putin had an op-ed in the New York Times basically saying that he felt like there was this trusting relationship developing between the United States and Russia. It was right after the gas attack in Syria and how Russia helped work with us to get the chemical weapons out of Syria. And then we go into Ukraine and then we start blaming Russia for the annexation of Crimea and trying to say that they were aggressing us when they weren't. And there's just so much. Since then, there's been so much misinformation and propaganda put out by the United States that's anti-Russian that now Putin is saying, I don't feel like I can trust them. I don't. There's a total breakdown in the relationship, and so that has to be repaired. But if I could just quickly get back to the presidential question, because a couple of things on that. First off, Miles and I are not running for president, so people are welcome to vote for us and choose who they want to vote for president. But if you look at all the predictions, it looks like Clinton, there's not really even a swing state barely in this country. It looks like it's going to be a landslide for Hillary Clinton. So if you're not happy with her positions, and I think people should actually look at her positions to get a sense of what they are, not listen to the spin that you hear, I think this is the year to vote third party, and I think a lot of people are going to do that. And in terms, especially in our races, you know, if you look at Chris Van Hollen, he's a career politician who has raised hundreds of millions of dollars over his career, especially as head of the DCCC from Wall Street, and is not shown a willingness to really stand up to the Democratic Party and fight for the people. So if you want to get rid of the wealth domination of our public policies, then you need to vote third party.
And we also look at Congressman Cummings, who was the platform committee chair and who pushed the TPP, who restricted everything, talks about Black Lives Matter. He has been very much a part of the Democratic Party machine for such a long time, especially these last 10 years, and has been very supportive of almost everything that the corporations have been pushing, even against his own original principles, from single payer, which he had claimed that he had supported over the past and had, yet he then goes and supports the health insurance industry, the banking industry, which, you know, you would never have thought that he would support the bankers. He didn't when President Bush was the president, but as soon as President Obama came into office, he then supported the banks and the bailout. And there's so many other examples where he has been more loyal to his party and to the corporations that control the agenda, the policies, than to the constituents of the 7th District.
Mm-hmm. So, folks, we do want you to join us. These are questions and comments you have for two candidates here in the state of Maryland. You just heard Miles Honig, who is running for the 7th Congressional District, which is now a seat held by Elijah Cummings. And Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's running the U.S. Senate seat now held by Barbara Mikulski,
who's retiring.
And it is a three-way race between Congressman Van Hollen of the 8th District and Kathy Schlega, a state delegate here in the state of Maryland, running Republican, and Margaret Flowers is in the studio running as Green Party candidate. Your time to talk about your thoughts about third parties, your thoughts about their campaigns, your thoughts about the people they're running against as well, and what they stand for, how you think you might vote, what questions you might have at 410-319-8888 to talk with both of our guests. You can also email us at talkatsteinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner to give us your thoughts about all that, 410-319-8888, and we'll come to your calls as they come in here for both Miles Honig and Margaret Flowers. So on our way to break here, a bunch of questions. I'm really curious about where you see the major distances are between your positions and your position, and I'm looking at Margaret Flowers, and I'll come right back to Miles. your position with Van Hollen. I mean, what's the linchpin of the difference there?
What it fundamentally comes down to is the ability to talk about the solutions that the majority of people support, but Chris Van Hollen is staying restricted in that Democratic agenda, which is defined by the wealthy elite. So if you look at health care, he has been pushing what's called a public option. I call it a profiteer's option because it's absolutely what the insurance companies want. They're screaming about having to pay for too much health care. And so they would love the government to create a public insurance where all the sick patients can be dumped and the private insurers can continue to insure the healthy and make a lot of money off of them. So this is not going to solve our health care crisis. It's never going to become a single payer. And Chris Van Hollen is misleading the public by saying he sees it as a path to single payer, something he only added to his platform after I was running and out there speaking about that. So on health care, one of the first things I'm going to do as your next senator is to introduce the Senate companion bill to H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, and fight for it because we've got to solve the health care crisis now. If you look at things like foreign policy, there are vast differences between us. He has, he's a career kind of foreign state family. He grew up in that environment.
Right.
He supports the president's agenda of intervention in Iraq and Syria. He supports our, expanded, military and aid to Israel, and that's being used to commit genocide against the Palestinian people and apartheid. He's pledged his fealty to Israel over and over again. I support a foreign policy that's based on respect for international law, for human rights, for national sovereignty. If you look at what's happening in Syria, it's all about the U.S. trying to create regime change against Bashar al-Assad, and that is not something we should be doing. And then finally, just one more big area, and there are others, but on the climate crisis, he's pursuing a tax and dividend approach of a market-based approach to solving the climate crisis and moving to renewable energies. We don't have time for that. We have to create a comprehensive plan at the national level with clear goals of 100% renewables aiming for 2030 and all of the other types of things we need to do in terms of transportation and agriculture and, building efficiency to address the climate crisis in a serious way and make it a public works program that will also create tens of millions of jobs and use that public investment to have a public return to move to a basic income. So those are some of the main things where we differ.
We have to take a very short break and come back. And we do, Alan and Carlos, you are the first two callers up. We're going to come to your calls, come back to a question from Miles Honig, and more. 410-319-8888. Email us at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. We'll be back quick. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner here with two of the Green Party candidates, Miles Honig and Margaret Flowers. Miles Honig running for the 7th Congressional District and Margaret Flowers running for the U.S. Senate. And on our way back to our conversation with them, I will remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. Let's go right to the phones of 410-319-8888. Alan, you're on the air. Welcome. Alan, you there?
Hello. I'm here.
You're on the air. Welcome.
Go right to the phones of 410-319-8888.
Alan, could you turn down your radio? You're on the air.
I turned it off. Thank you all for taking my call.
Good morning,
Mark. And
good morning.
Your guest.
Good morning.
I'm a white guy, totally support the Green Party. I want to thank Miles, Margaret, and I know Josh Harris probably would love to have been there with you all.
He'll be back before the election.
Yeah. I'd like to have the Center for Emerging Media, all the journalists out there, Luke Broadwater, and Margaret, I'm sure you can answer this question, but it has never been answered on your show is which banking board will Barbara Mikulski be retiring to? Mm. Anybody know?
I have no idea. I don't know if she is or she is not going to a banking board, so I have no idea.
Isn't she part of the banking committee?
Yeah, but I don't know if she's going to be on a bank board. I mean, I haven't heard anything about that. And if she is, the news will cover it, I'm sure, if she is.
That's the question I want the journalist, the really investigative journalist, to find out.
But the question is, why would we investigate? Well, wait. I mean, if she's on a bank board, they'll announce it, and then we'll know, and then we can talk about it.
Yeah, it'll be too late. What I'm saying is this is ammunition for the Green Party to use against the Republicans and Democrats to show that our Democratic Party has been in bed just as much as Republicans with the banking in Wall Street. I'll bet you we'll find out after, and it'll be too late. It'll be after the fact that Barbara Mikulski's going to be going to Goldman Sachs or whatever. Of course she's keeping it silent. I would too. But
okay,
I
hear you. That could be true, but again, I don't like to make conjectures on people's lives if I don't know what was really going on.
Yeah, we don't know what she's going to do. We don't know what her retirement plans are. But we do know, of course, that the revolving door is very strong in Washington. So it would be no surprise if she or, of course, President Obama or anybody who leaves office to go to either a Goldman Sachs or any financial institution or any corporate institution, become a lobbyist. We just don't know that. But it's expected that that's where they often go because it's the presidency, the Senate, the House. It's a stepping stone for a corporate gig.
Right, but Barbara Mikulski is 80 years old. I doubt she's looking for stepping stones at this point in life. I don't think that's where Barbara Mikulski's probably going. Who knows what she's going to do in her retirement. But thanks for the call, Alan. Let's go another caller. 410-319-8888 as we talk with two of our state Green Party candidates. 410-319-8888. Carlos, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good morning, Carlos.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for calling.
I wanted to state, I heard that Margaret said that she was against the public option. Chris Van Hollen's been saying that he supports it because all the progressive groups are supporting the public option. And I wanted to know what was wrong with people, with the progressive groups supporting it. Why are they supporting it? What is the story behind that? If that's what the progressive groups and Bernie Sanders are supporting, the public option, you know, why are they not reaching for a single payer at this point, and why are all these progressive groups supporting the public option?
That's a very interesting
Margaret
question.
Flowers.
Yeah, back in 2008, 2009, 2010, when the health reform was being undergoing its process in Congress, it was really interesting that at that time, 80% of Democratic voters and a majority of the American public support a national improved Medicare for All or single payer healthcare system. But you had this the Democratic Party that was putting forth what later became the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which was really a huge bailout to the insurance industry. And so the so-called progressive groups used the concept of a public option to divide those who wanted a single-payer healthcare system and convince people that this was going to be a backdoor to a single-payer system, that it was all we could get and you should fight for that, even though we knew early on in 2009 that it was never going to be in the final legislation. And so the public option is not a solution. It's not going to solve our healthcare crisis. It's just going to add one more insurance to an already very overly complex system. But one thing that was very interesting during that time is that Jim Messina, who was a chief of staff in the White House for President Obama, would meet with the progressive organizations every Tuesday at the Hilton on Connecticut Avenue and tell them, these are the things that you can say, and if you don't stay within these talking points, we've got your funders over here, we're going to pull your funding. And so they really used the donors to these organizations to keep them in line. And that's why it's so critical that people understand this time that this is not a solution. It's not going to solve our healthcare crisis. It's keeping us from advocating and fighting for what we need, which is a Medicare for All system.
Any more thought? Oh, go ahead, Miles.
Yeah, and also just the idea that every once in a while something may appear to be good coming out of Obamacare, ACA, such as adding children at a certain age to the plan or pre-existing conditions. But that's only if you accept that the health insurance industry is the driving engine behind healthcare, when it shouldn't be. And once you start accepting them as being the primary driver, then any improvement seems good. But in reality, what you need to do is get rid of the entire system and start afresh with a single-payer Medicare for All healthcare system.
So if you're in Congress or in Senate, mm-hmm. and before we go back to phones here, and we stick for the healthcare just a moment, then you know that the majority of Congress is not going to go with a single-payer system at this moment. So what's the strategy?
So we have a healthcare crisis. We have tens of millions of people who have no insurance at all, tens of millions who are underinsured, so they may have health insurance, but they still can't afford the healthcare they need. We have poor health outcomes. That reality of that crisis is not going away. The reality of the political will for a single-payer system in Congress, that's the movable factor. That's something that can be influenced by popular opinion. When people fight for it, we can put pressure on Congress to do this. And that's why the public option was used to divide and weaken that movement that wanted a single-payer system in 2009. Now, what most people don't know is that on December 16th, 2009, we got a single-payer bill to the floor of the Senate for the first time in the history of the United States. And that was introduced by Senator Sanders. Harry Reid was head of the Senate. He skipped over it, didn't let it come to the floor. A number of us, many people from Maryland and the surrounding area, went down there and protested. They allowed it to come to the floor the next week, where it was stayed for 3 hours. It was an 800-page amendment that would have replaced the Senate bill with a single-payer bill. So I was one of the people that was involved in that fight to get that to the floor, and that showed me that we can do it if we believe that we can do it and use our power.
Right. No, mobilize and organize constituents all over the country.
Right.
I think one thing one of the things I think Sanders' campaign did, not to digress into this, was to re-legitimize the battle around single payer, mm-hmm. to put that in people's minds that is not gone, it's not inconceivable. It's not something we can't attain. So I think that's a huge part of the discussion. So
yeah.
Back to the phones here.
No, I was just going to say that, unfortunately, he's the person that is introducing the public option legislation in the Senate. And I think that he's doing that because he needs he wants to maintain his leadership in the committees there. And that's what the party's asking him to do. But people shouldn't be fooled by that.
No, and I actually think maybe it's a little more nuanced than that. But I think that's part of it.
Possibly.
But I think 410-319-8888. Let's go to analysis. You're on the air.
People shouldn't be fooled by that.
Hey, good morning, Alice. You can turn on your radio. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mark, man. How are you?
Candidates.
Good to hear from you.
Hanging in.
Good morning.
Good to hear from you. Good to see you the other day. Let me very quickly state that I support the candidates on the air.
Thank you.
Dr. Flowers, I've had a chance to meet a few times, and I look forward to meeting candidate Honig and calling him Congressman Honig.
Thank you.
Very soon. A couple quick things. I have had the conversation a number of times in recent months that even with what's happening on the presidential level, we have to begin to make inroads in terms of the seats that third party folks can hold before the next presidential election in this particular cycle. Else we're never going to break out of this thing. I think that's what you all are talking about. But very briefly, my question is, and you may have just touched on it because I'm driving and I just parked, so I may have missed what you just said on it. In terms of Bernie Sanders, I would have hoped that he would have thrown his machine and his weight in hard with Jill Stein when he had the opportunity. And somebody commented to me that perhaps the reason that he did not is not so much that because he wouldn't have thought it was a good idea, but maybe he was party tied. Maybe there's some fine print, which I don't claim to understand all of in terms of the parties, but somehow he was hog tied because he decided to run as a Democrat. Where he could not or decided not to throw in hard with Jill and help Jill and the rest of the campaign. What's your read on that?
Rebecca?
Miles, do you want to respond?
Well, I know that he has never been very supportive of third-party candidates, even while Senator Vermont. So he has always been a supporter of the Democratic Party. He's voted 98% with the Democrats most of the time. That's why they've given him leadership positions. His positions have been quite liberal and progressive, but he's always stopped at a certain point and would not go beyond the point that the corporate funders of the Democratic Party would prevent him from going. So there's a limit to where he would go and where he would take his positions.
I think that's probably true. Again, I think that sometimes, you know, when we have these critiques, he's never – what corporate money has he taken?
Very little, is my understanding.
Yeah. Right. So I don't think he's been part of that.
I think it's more,
the party itself.
Yeah, party itself has absolutely.
He's always caucused with the Democrats.
Yeah, that's
right. And he agreed early on to support whoever was the nominee of the Democratic Party, and he honored that. And I think a lot of people were excited and turned on by his campaign. I think that his success really came from the movement that preceded it, the Occupy movement and the other movements that created this political atmosphere for him to thrive, but it energized a lot of new people, and people were really disappointed to see him then return back into the fold of working with the Democratic Party and not kind of carrying that revolutionary spirit forward. I look at he's a pragmatist, and he's got two more years of this term in the Senate, and he wants to stay in the positions he has in the committees, and I know how he operates, and he wants to be as effective as he can be within that environment, and I think that's why he took that position.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. And who's next up online here? It's Eric. You're on the air. No. Eric, go ahead. Yes. Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
This is a good segue into my question.
Okay.
It's one of the problems that Libertarian and Green Party candidates have is they don't have the money that the Democrats and Republicans have to get their message out there and to be able to campaign on an equal footing. What is your position on campaign financing, which, forgive me, I personally believe is one of the greatest corruption influence in American politics and is one of the prime reasons why we're where we are. I personally think it should be totally eliminated, but you don't hear many people talk about getting rid of campaign financing. If anything, Citizens United entrenched it even more and is degrading the system even more. What's the Green Party's position on that?
Who wants to leave first?
So I support, a constitutional amendment. A corporation should not be people, and money should not be speech. And, Citizens United has really tied the hands of Congress. I believe that we should have publicly financed elections, and short of that, we should have much greater transparency in who is funding the current elections. You know, this is the issue of our time. It's the wealth domination of our political process, which means that public policies overwhelmingly benefit those at the top and go against the interests of the rest of the population. And we have two major political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, who are part of that system, who are deeply entrenched in that Wall Street money. And that's why it's critical for us to build an alternative party that is not taking that corporate money. And short of, you know, having public financing, we don't have that right now, but we are raising money, and we're raising it through small donations, and I hope that people listening will support the Green Party candidates in Maryland at all levels. And we're in a really different era where we now have social media, and it'll be interesting to see the impact of that, because as I travel around the state, I've met people who found out about me through social media, even though the major commercial outlets have, you know, censored me. So it's an interesting time, and we're using all whatever tools we have to reach people and run a serious campaign.
You want to add to that, Miles, a bit?
Yes. Also, do want to point out that it is really only the Green Party that does not accept corporate contributions. Mm-hmm. Maybe at a local level, a candidate running for Libertarian may not get a lot of corporate support or business support, but as a party, they are very willing to take corporate contributions. It is the Green Party that does not. So money in politics is a major problem. It's what controls the elections in so many ways. And it also goes to the whole point of, should there even be term limits? And I know that's a split within a lot of parties, for or against. I would personally take the argument that we should not have term limits, but what we need is a way of having every person running to be on such an equal footing with those who are already an incumbent that each incumbent actually has to fight every 2 years or 4 years or 6 years for their position, giving everyone an equal opportunity. Otherwise, who is going to be able to quit their job after 12, you know, their position and be there for 12 years and come back to what? You know, who has a job that they can come back to 12 years later and pick up where they left off? That's only for those who have the means to do that. And that's not the people that we really need in Congress and in the Senate.
Let's go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. Sergeant Freeman on the air. Welcome.
Yes, hello.
Good morning. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well.
This is Sergeant Freeman.
Yes.
Barbara McCloskey's name was mentioned.
Right.
And I perked up. I want to just say, I'm not sure I'm coming at the tail end of y'all's conversation. I want to give her, you know, praise and a commendation for her service and her time. And your people on your show, they're running for office. If you really want to endear yourself to veterans, I would suggest you reference and research the senator's legacy in regards to veterans. I know her personally, and I literally have been to hospitals and medical centers for VA where I've seen in person she laid her magic out there. Also, the fact that whatever happens on the Capitol Hill, she's always there to give her opinions on certain things that right-wing people are trying to do. For example, privatizing commissaries, mm-hmm. Also pension reduction for veterans and whatnot. She kind of, you know, put herself out there to be the torchbearer for veterans. So
okay.
And the other part, I want to ask a question. I was informed yesterday. Correct me if I'm wrong. I was informed yesterday there's a provision on the Affordable Health Care Act that the 7 million children will be protected in regards to moving forward if the Affordable Health Care Act gets repealed, because they receive dental care, free dental care, for example. And we all know that if you don't have good hygienic dental care, then it permeates through your body.
Okay. So what's the question?
I want to ask these guys, is that true, and you cannot repeal that part of the 7 million children getting that part of Affordable Health Care Act? And I never say Obamacare. I just said it, but let's not say that anymore.
Gotcha. Thank you so much for your call, as always. Margaret?
Sure. Yeah, important questions. I mean, first off, I'll take the healthcare one. I don't know of any provision that says that if they repeal the Affordable Care Act, and I have a hard time calling it Affordable Care because it's not, but I understand not wanting to call it Obamacare either. I don't know of any provision out there that says that that is protected. I think if Congress repeals it, they can decide, you know, what they repeal, and that's up to that process. And in fighting for a national improved Medicare for All healthcare system, we believe very strongly that it should be comprehensive and include dental, mental health, substance abuse, vision, hearing, long-term care, all of that. And I'm very concerned about what's happening with our veterans and what's happening with veterans healthcare and not funding it adequately. I've worked with a lot of veterans. It's really distressing to me to see so many unemployed veterans, homeless veterans in our country. I think that's really despicable. I also believe that we shouldn't be, that part of the reason that the VA system is under strain is this wars that we've had going on for so long now and creating more and more casualties of that system, either being wounded physically or the PTSD that we're seeing veterans coming home with. And I think we need a foreign policy that doesn't think that our military is cannon fodder, that understands that we need to take an approach of respecting international law and sovereignty and not being willing to put our soldiers in harm's way like we are.
There was something that the last caller said that I just want to kind of explore for a moment. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious what you think the Green Party has to do other than kind of demanding to be on debates. I'm not saying you should not be in a debate. You should mm-hmm. be in a debate, I think, because, I mean, if you need to hear all the voices, I would think that both the Libertarian and Green candidates for president should also be on the yes. debates nationally. I mean, yes. for America to really hear all the ideas that are out there. But what about, I mean, when you have a party where you only have barely 100 people voting in your primary, here in Baltimore City. The Green Party seems to put a lot of emphasis on running in elections. But what about the hardcore organizing actually builds an organization that fights for social justice and change?
I'd like to address that, yes.
And builds, because it seems like you kind of perennially remain this minority that can't break out of that status. There must be some other way to begin organizing to make that happen, or to approach elections to make that happen, maybe concentrating in one or two councilman-like districts and trying to gain power locally to push. It seems like there's some disconnect here with you and the people.
Right. Well, one of the things that we're planning, in fact, is being planned for November 2nd at Red Emma's, is a panel discussion with Brandy Baker, who is my wife, who is a member of the GNC of the Green Party, and Tony Nedge of the Stein campaign. It's called The Case for the Green Party. So what do we do after the election? This is a way of organizing, of getting people in Baltimore and the region to really build a Green Party. Forget the elections, the election will be over, but we still need to continue. And you're right, we're known because of the elections, but what we need to do as a party is to expand, reach out to those groups that rarely come to us or even know that we're around. I was on the campus here about a week ago. A lot of people did not know of the Green Party, but they were very open to the ideas that we had. So we do need to expand and talk to people. And this thing is not a electoral event. It's really, what do we do afterwards as a Green Party? So it's November 2nd. Come to Red Emma's at 7 p.m.
I think, you know, we need to recognize that the Green Party was only recognized as a national party in 2001, so it hasn't been around for a long time. Most of the rules are written by Democrats and Republicans, and they're written in a way that makes it very restrictive and difficult for alternative parties to grow. So in terms of the Maryland Green Party, we got 25,000 signatures so that we could get ballot status. I think that was a significant amount of work for a party that doesn't have a lot of resources. And so to say that there's nothing really going on between elections when we have this organizing and so much of our energy has to go into just staying on the ballot, that's a big challenge. But we're also building the infrastructure, and that's part of why I wanted to run a statewide campaign. In addition to, I would like to be in the Senate. I'm ready to serve as your next senator. But it's also, we're building, continuing to build, because it's not that we haven't been doing it, but we're continuing to build that infrastructure. And we're not going away after November 8th. This whole thing for me is about building political power for the transformation that we require. And we can't do that by voting for the parties who are taking us in the wrong direction. We have to build a political alternative now.
And I would look forward to maybe post-election. I think it could be an interesting discussion to have on the air about third parties and where they go and what we have to do, and the number of third parties in Maryland, at least two that I can think of, that are trying to actively move. So I'd be interested to hear that conversation.
I would also be very interested in the spin that comes afterwards when the election is over, how the major media is spinning, whatever the results are. If Jill Stein or others really do well or better than expected, how will they spin it? How will they talk about it, or will they even discuss it at all?
Well, I think if Jill Stein gets more than 2% of the vote, you'll hear, I mean, some people will be talking about that.
And if she gets 5%, then we'll
really
get federal funds, and that will really boost
that will change the
party
right,
to a new level. Yeah.
Exactly. Unless they change the rules for that.
Exactly.
Right, unless they change the rules.
Let's try to get one more caller in here, 410-319-8888. Maybe this email came in as well. David writes in, last night at a movie at the Senator, which was about the nation's health care, which had a comparison of health care between the U.S. and Canada, Margaret spoke about how she was working with Donna Edwards on Single Payer, but she didn't find that Donna maintained her support, which led her to come to the Green Party, at least my understanding. Would she talk about how she moved to the Green Party and about the virtues of Canadian health care? We talked a bit about that already. You answered some of this, he said. How can listeners help with Margaret and Miles' campaign? How can they contribute? Thanks for giving these candidates time to present their positions on important issues for the future of the country. So how did they get in touch? Because I think we hit the single payer stuff already.
Well, I have a Facebook page, I have a web page, but if you contact my email at mylesh302@gmail.com, that would be probably the best way of reaching me directly.
Right. And my website is flowersforsenate.org. We also are on Facebook and Twitter. But we just quickly showed the documentary last night, Now is the Time, Healthcare for Everybody. And it was filmed, a lot of it was filmed in Baltimore and features a lot of people from Baltimore. So,
Who did that film?
It's Laurie Simons and Terry Sternberg. They did the healthcare movie, and this was their sequel to that. And it was really about, okay, we're 6 years into the ACA. It's not working. What do we do? And so it was a really great discussion afterwards.
So let me try to get a couple calls in here, maybe one call. 410-319-8888. Peggy, you're on the air. We only have a couple minutes left.
Hello?
We only have a couple minutes, Peggy. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I'm officially a registered Democrat, and I was thinking I'm going to vote Green Party, but would it help if I change my voter?
No, you do not.
Not at this point. The date is passed.
Okay. But let's answer that question. Yeah. I mean, the date is passed to change your affiliation before. Well, the date is passed to register to vote in the upcoming election.
Except if you vote early.
If you are registered
and you
change to a Green Party status, if we can reach 1% registered Greens in the state of Maryland, we no longer have to put resources into collecting ballot signatures. So if people want to support the Green Party, change your affiliation to Green, and that will be a huge help.
All right. I want to thank you both for being here. Also, you can register to vote if you vote early. I mean, early register. If you vote early in polling places, you can register that day and vote as
great
well.
Great day. Okay.
So
very
let people know
very
that. Good. Dr. Margaret Flowers, running for the U.S. Senate, Green Party ticket. Miles Honig, running for the 7th Congressional District and Green Party. Thank you both so much for being
here.
Thank you very much,
Margaret.
We're taking a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with State's Attorney Mallory Mosby. Stay with us.